Welcome and thank you for joining us. This is actually our inaugural episode of a new project of mine I'm excited to share with you all. This is the first episode of Sacktown Talks, and a little bit about myself just before we get going here. My name is Gibran Maciel. I'm from San Diego and have moved to Sacramento 7 years ago. I wanted to work for the state legislature, and you know what they say, be careful what you wish for you shall find it. And I spent 7 years in this California State Assembly. And I am currently on break, which is actually a blessing because I've been able to take some time to launch this project, which I've been very excited about. With that being said, though I have been a political animal in my professional life, this is not a political space. Sacktown Talks is rather a celebration of this wonderful city, which I've fallen in love with over the last 7 years, and the people who make it awesome. You know, when I moved here from San Diego, I got a lot of kind of quizzical looks like, oh, San Diego, why did you move here from San Diego? Why? Well, there are absolutely remarkable people here in Sacramento. And so with that, I'd like to welcome on our first guest, Dr. Jan Moulton. I'm absolutely pinching myself that I've been able to get you on here. can you introduce yourself for us?
Yeah, I'm Jan Moulton. I am a professor at the University of California, Davis, and I direct the stem cell program in the Institute for Regenerative Cures.
So you are, I think, being modest there. I was reading about you in preparation for this interview, I read that you were at one point named one of the top 50 most influential stem cell scientists in the world. Is that correct?
That is correct, yeah. That was very kind of my colleagues to vote me as that. And I think that was right after we got a few large grants to run clinical stem cell trials. So
okay,
it was a good year. Yeah.
what is that like? I've heard sometimes in the science world, you're sort of working on your science and working on your research, but you also have to make sure that you're keeping the money coming in as well. Are you oftentimes working in both tracks like that? How does that work?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think what people don't realize is that when you're a scientist, you have to pay your own salary and pay the salary of the people who work for you, because the university, you know, doesn't do that. It comes from grant funding. And so we've been super lucky here in California to have the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine that's funded renovation of our space. We're in an old warehouse that got renovated in Sacramento, which is really cool. It's now the Institute for Regenerative Cures. 109,000 square feet, about 200 people working in there.
Oh, wow.
And they're all funded by grants. You can get some money from the university for teaching, but in general, the grants are funding all of the research scientists' salaries. And so it's constant, you know, writing grants to apply for the money so that you can do the research. And I like writing grants, fortunately. We've been lucky enough to get some, you know, enough to keep our research teams going. And then our whole mission is to develop better therapies for patients who need them. And so we're really in the translational space between the bench and the bedside, and just trying to make the world in healthcare a better place.
That's great work that you're doing there. What specific, are you working on you focusing on specific diseases or maladies that you're focused on, or how does that work?
Yeah.
I'm a lay person. So.
Oh yeah, it's a great question. We have 15 different disease teams, and so those teams are working toward therapies for patients in a certain disease area. So for instance, we have a neurodegenerative disease team that mostly works on Huntington's disease, also Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, juvenile Huntington's disease, and then some rare diseases that affect kids, which are really hard, CDKL5 deficiency and Angelman syndrome and things like that. That's just one of the teams. And so there are 15 of those, and they're all trying to help the patients. So they start with the physician who wants to bring better answers to their patients who come to see them. And the last thing that any of our doctors want to say is, no, I can't do anything for you.
We can't help you.
So they come back to the scientists, we go back to the bench, we work with the really brilliant scientists that we have at UC Davis and around the world, really, because research is international. And then we try to come up with better approaches, often using stem cells or using regenerative medicine, which is where you can teach the body to heal itself. And then we try to get that into clinical trials to see if it's efficacious in any way. So it's just really a very rewarding and exciting career, always with the end goal of helping the patients.
That's absolutely amazing. So yeah. when I met you for the first time, we met at a movie showing for Taking Off the Mask,
yeah,
which was a movie to raise awareness for Huntington's disease.
Great movie.
Before having seen that film, I'd actually never, I'd never even really understood, really encountered, really had any awareness of Huntington's disease. Is part of what you're working on sort of like the diseases that are not, you know, like cancer is a big one, right? Huntington's maybe doesn't have as much attention, but it's absolutely devastating to the people who it affects. It sounds like you're working on diseases all across the spectrum. Some that might not have as many people that they affect. Does that make it harder to get funding? Or?
Well, it's interesting. For something like Huntington's disease, we started out being funded by foundations and family members who really care about the disease.
Okay.
We still get money from foundations, and they provide seed funding to start, you know, growing your research and to be competitive for grants so that you can really get things done. You need some figures, you know, to put into the grant. You need some evidence that your ideas and your data will work. And that's what those foundations or philanthropic donations from concerned families, that's what they help build. And especially for junior investigators who are the smart young people who are really moving and shaking the fields of science, that really allows them to then get their first federal grant or their first CIRM grant, California Institute for Regenerative Medicine, and be able then to hire people, hire technicians to help them and move the research forward.
So you mentioned CIRM. And
yeah.
I'd like to touch a little bit on the importance of CIRM. And actually, you know, finding funding for regenerative medicine, I think, is how you and I have a mutual friend in Roman Reed.
Yes, absolutely. Roman's awesome.
Yeah, yeah. And so he actually said hello to me on Facebook the other day. He is, you know, Roman, I hope you're listening. We're both, I think, in admiration of you. He and his father were advocating for a $3 add-on to moving violations for spinal cord injuries. Another one of your sources of funding is the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine, is CIRM, right?
Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about how CIRM came to be the ballot proposition that enabled the bond funding to move forward? And
sure.
I think we're getting ready for, that bond funding can't go on forever, right? So maybe talk to us about next steps.
Sure. So CIRM is our California State Stem Cell Funding Agency. It has funded so much really groundbreaking research throughout our state and really internationally, because a lot of people collaborate with us. If they're a research team from outside of California, they provide their own funding, but it's you know, cumulative, and we leverage each other's discoveries. So really in California, they now have, I think, like 30 clinical trials. People have been cured of diseases such as ADA deficiency, which is bubble baby syndrome. You know, 30 kids cured and going to school and living normal lives that wouldn't have been. So it's really an incredible agency. It's funded the places where we do the science. That was the first thing that they did. The first was training, so that we could train the students and the next generation. The second was giving out some smaller grants, and then funding these major facilities where we do regenerative medicine. And we were lucky enough to get one of those. That was my first mission, was to apply for that when I came back to Sacramento in 10 years. I was born around here, went to school here, started at Sac State, went to Davis, went away for a few years, and then came back a decade ago. and was very happy to find that the CIRM funding was in place. And it really has made California the mecca for stem cell research and regenerative medicine.
Does the bond funding have a, is it running out? How does that work out? Is there a certain amount that they can issue, and are we getting close to the end?
It was for 10 years, and they've leveraged it and had additional donations and philanthropy, and they now have enough money to keep funding grants and clinical trials at the rate that they are for a few more years until 2020. And at that point, I believe we will have another bond initiative. I hope that Californians will see what, you know, what their vote and their tax dollars can do to improve their own health and that of the family and their family members and that of the world, because it's really paradigm shifting what CIRM has done.
Okay. So you're confident that when it's time to, whether it be reauthorize bond funding or make a case to taxpayers and to voters, that you will be able to demonstrate clear clear benefits to California, clear benefits to the treatment and curing of diseases, that that this will be something that the public sees value in.
Yeah, absolutely. You can already see the good that's happening. Just one of the diseases that we're working on, critical limb ischemia, we're trying to prevent amputation for patients who have diabetes they don't have circulation down into their legs. It starts out as peripheral artery disease and it becomes critical limb ischemia. For those patients, it is billions of dollars to take care of those patients. First of all, when they have sores on their legs and need home health care every day to come and take care of the wounds, or being in intensive care unit. And then after they get the amputation, it's just a huge amount of health care.
Sure.
Yeah, devastating, first of all, but a huge amount of health care. And the stem cells that could revascularize the limb are just, maybe $100,000 to make that dose, maybe less, trying to get that number down. The cost-benefit analysis, it really proves that regenerative medicine is the wave of the future and really will change how healthcare is done and help us manage our healthcare costs, which is critical.
Interesting. That's really interesting to me that you were able to sort of see your work as on so many different sides of the healthcare management spectrum, both from helping individual patients, but also from a policy perspective of this is going to help us lower healthcare costs, which is critically needed.
We need to think about the cost of any of these cures that we're developing, because if it's not cost effective, then insurance is not going to cover it. They're not going to pick it up.
And then people can't get it.
And so people can't get it, yeah. And we really want to develop things that everyone can have if they need it.
How do you, can you describe to us, maybe explain a little bit how you start bending that cost curve down a little bit for you develop a treatment for example, what you were just describing to revascularize a limb, and maybe the first dose is $100,000 or the first dose is $1 million. What steps can you take to help bend that cost curve down?
That's a great question. So we, first of all, to do this type of therapy, we use cells from the bone marrow, and they're called mesenchymal stem cells, and they're the paramedics of the body. They're these broad, flat cells that grow in people's bone marrow. So we take an aspirate from a young, healthy donor such as yourself, take them into our good manufacturing practice facility, and then we put them into flasks. They're like little mini aquariums with fluid that feeds them. We grow them up. They keep dividing.
You're kind of like harvesting.
We grow them up into a huge dose. And then we freeze down little bags of different doses for different patients. And then they get qualified and tested and make sure there's no viruses and nothing bad in them. More recently, instead of all of these little tiny separate plastic aquariums, we've gone to cell hotels where they're all stacked.
It's like a little hotel.
It's just stacked like a high-rise hotel, and the cells are all growing on these thinner sheets of plastic. So it's like one thing, and this costs much less than all the individual flasks that we used to grow them in. It's less media and growth factors and plastic. And now we can further cut those costs by growing them just in one hollow fiber bioreactor. It generates an equal number of the cells, but it's just a cassette about this big, and it's much more cost effective. So we're always thinking about the cost of goods and how can we make the doses more effective and more cost effective as well.
That's remarkable. You kind of just made my head spin.
That's what we do every day. I love it.
So it sounds like the idea is if you can do it once, then from there you can sort of find a way to wrestle the cost curve down.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And is that true for sort of across the spectrum of diseases that you're working on or treatments that you're working on?
Yeah. I just got back from the meeting, MSC 2017, which was about these paramedic type cells. And we discussed ways to use the standard best, cut down the cost of goods, and then to use the same platform across many types of culture and tweaking the cells so that they can be best for different diseases.
Okay.
But using really the same cost-effective platforms. And so that was a big topic of conversation. It was a really exciting meeting.
So the development of platforms to help facilitate your research.
Yeah. The clinical trials, really, and the future medicines.
Okay. Can I, if I could ask you, see, I'm such a plebe at this topic that I don't know if it's off topic or not. Okay. I had heard that, you know, you make a groundbreaking discovery that gets published right away.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But we might not be necessarily so eager to publish the stuff that didn't work. Is that right?
That's a good question.
If I have like a line of inquiry of research, and maybe I have like good reason to believe that a certain a certain avenue of research might be fruitful, and I pursue it, you know, maybe for a year or something, and it winds up not working, but I don't publish that anywhere. Maybe you get the same bright idea and you have good reason to believe for the same reason, right? That it might work, and then you spend a year on it. And you know, is that something that that you ever think about? Is that a thing?
Yeah.
Basically,
it's a really good question, because you don't want to go down the same path that led to failure for somebody else. And a really good place to look for things that were tried really carefully and just did not work is in, I hate to say it, but graduate students' theses that they published. And thank gosh, now with the internet and Google, those are all searchable, pretty much searchable. So you can, if you have an idea, you want to look up and see if anybody's published it before you go to PubMed, and then you can search more deeply and look into different thesis publications. And so if someone's, you know, publishing a thesis and they have a hot paper coming out, or they're patenting it or something, they'll put a hold on it for up to a year.
Oh, wow.
But after that, they're searchable. So it's a great question. We try not to recreate any wheels if people have already made some progress.
Interesting. Yeah. Good to know. You know, when you talked about Google there for a second, it had occurred to me that you and I are sort of part of the same meta generation that sort of grew up analog, and then the digital revolution sort of happened within the space of our adulthood, right?
Yeah.
You know, for me, it actually, you know, my professional development was already within a firmly digitized world, mostly, right? When you were working in the lab, you know, like the mid 90s, and the internet was just starting to come online, you know, what was that like? How has this explosion of accessibility of information, of interconnectedness between your peers and cross-disciplinary type of applications, sort of facilitated by the internet, has that changed your work, how you approach things? How has that changed things for your profession?
Absolutely. First of all, just communicating with other scientists, searching for things that have been done, searching the records, what's been published, what's been patented, clinicaltrials.gov, what's already in clinical trials. I remember it was probably in the late 80s, I'm not sure, somebody told me about this thing called email. And I said, what are you talking about? I don't have time to look at messages from people. I'm busy at the bench all day, you know, doing my experiments. But yeah, boy, has that changed the world. And now another thing that's really interesting is social media for scientists. Most scientists are doing some type of social media to talk to other scientists, to run ideas off of each other, to maybe promote what they or their students have done. And it's really very different than when I first started, where we were just working in our lab and with our group, and that's what you knew, and maybe somebody would come lecture for you, but you learned that, you know, you might go lecture for somebody else, or you learned about what they were doing.
You cross pollinate.
You can just learn about everybody, yeah, worldwide. So it's kind of like, poof. It's great, really great.
You know, so I'll use a sort of a quick analogy here. We were talking a little bit before we started. You know, one of my personal hobbies is martial arts, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. And sort of the development of martial arts has sort of been in a, for the longest time, it's been in a vacuum.
Yeah.
Right? You had all these different schools of karate. You had Okinawa karate, Shotokan karate. And sort of they were different dojos, and you could, you know, you weren't even really allowed to train with the other schools. You know, that your style of kicking was your style of kicking. And, you know,
interesting.
So they were sort of purposely matured in silos. And that really wasn't very helpful for the advancement of the art in terms of developing best practices in under environments of duress.
Very right. Similar, because that word silos, we don't like silos in science. At least here at UC Davis, we don't. Some institutions still have them, but we really try to break down those silos and get everything out there so we can develop the best options for human health together as teams, as collaborations, and mm-hmm. just keep it wide open.
Now, this isn't necessarily a value that everyone is always going to share, right? If someone's working on something and they sort of want to take credit for it, or if they sort of, it's sort of their own, you're the leader, right? It's sort of incumbent on you to encourage openness and to encourage collaboration, even when it might not seem immediately fruitful, but to rather open up lines of communication so that people can sort of understand the strains on each other's workload and capacity and stuff like that. You are, I would imagine, tasked with ensuring that your scientists sort of all work together and break down these silos. Is that right?
Yeah, and you know, when somebody publishes their work, and it can take between 1 and 3 years to really get the experiments to where you can publish a good manuscript that's meaningful. Once they publish it, then you want everybody to know about it. There shouldn't be any secrecy anymore. You just really want people to be able to discover it, learn from it, and go forward. But there can be some, you know, some sense of secrecy up to that point, because they're just trying to wrap up their studies and not get scooped by another team. So that's the balancing act that we always do.
I'm going to shift gears here a little bit, if that's okay. And I sort of wanted to, you know, talk to you a little bit about, frankly, about being a woman in your field. The hard sciences have struggled to recruit women in STEM, right? And you got your Bachelor's of Science in 1988 and your PhD in a male-dominated field. What challenges and opportunities did you come across in advancing your education, your career, and research because you're a woman?
Yeah, it's a good question. There are still some fields that I feel are very male-dominated, such as surgery, for instance. My colleagues really feel it. I have not felt that so much here in California, because growing up in California, it just never occurred to me that there were things girls couldn't do, you know? And
that's awesome.
My mom didn't raise me that way. And so I had a fantastic mentor, Dr. Don Cohn. He never treated females any differently. None of our team in Los Angeles did. We were all, you know, equal members of the team pulling forward to make the science better. And then here at UC Davis, I mean, we've had fantastic female leaders. So I really have not felt that kind of, sexism that others can feel. What is sometimes kind of, interesting to me is that people will come into our lab and immediately figure that I am the administrative assistant. I think just the way I look, I don't feel like cutting my hair, I wear dresses, you know. I don't know why, but I'll say something like, oh, they don't let me touch the packages, and they'll look at me, and I'll just lose them, and then they kind of look at my badge and go, oh, you're a scientist, okay, oh, never mind. So it's kind of that assumption that, you know, girls wouldn't be the scientist in the room, but it's okay. Yeah. We get past that, yeah.
And hopefully now it's just a thing where you're just sort of embarrassed for them, even.
Oh, it's okay. It's just kind of funny. It's all right.
That's really heartening to know. I think there's been some pushback, I think, on calls for diversity and inclusivity. I think it was just last week or the week before that we saw the ugliness over at Google, the manifesto and the memo sort of against inclusivity. It's absolutely heartening to know that here at UC Davis, there's a environment where that's totally the opposite, right?
Yeah, many of our leaders are females, so it's,
That's wonderful.
There are always going to be, errant views in society. we don't suffer from them too much here.
More broadly, when you look at the pipeline of people coming into STEM, you know, through the graduates and undergrads, do you feel like there's eventually going to be like an evening out of?
Yeah, I'm hoping that there will. And we have this fabulous program that trains high school students. We get high school students to come work with us every summer. And they work hard and they win that honor to do it. And this year we had 9 girls and 1 boy. And last year we had 8 girls and 2 boys.
Wow.
So it's, awesome. Yeah, so that's that generation. And they're very dedicated and very earnest students, and did great things this summer. So, I think in the younger generation, I see that there aren't barriers to being a girl.
That's awesome. When I think of sort of the big hubs for science and for research and for tech and biotech, Sacramento doesn't necessarily come to mind. Yet you're here you are. Here we are doing amazing work.
It should.
It's probably just my own thing.
No, I mean, it should, and I think it will in the future. So we think of, like the Bay Area, all the techs there,
right,
the science and everything.
I sort of felt like we've been in the shadow of the Bay Area for so long.
Well, people think of Davis and they think about, cows and strawberries and things like that. But we have really a lot of great tech going on, and we have a great mission to expand our campus, get more industry into campus, work with the city, grow our tech enterprise here.
Okay.
Based on people working with the university and with our good manufacturing practice facility to make these living medicines that are the cell therapies. And so we are in an aggressive push to grow. We have the people. We have a great place to live,
and so this is like a UC Davis wide initiative.
Yeah, with the city. Yeah,
with the city.
Yeah, and our new chancellor, Dr. May, shout out, is very much behind this. He's great.
Is there a name for this initiative?
I think we call it the master plan, but I'm not sure.
Okay.
Master plan.
Okay.
But yeah, we have like drawings for the buildings that are going to be put up and everything. So. A great investment, and I have to point out that the price per square foot here is about half of what it is in the Bay Area. So, why not be here if you're a startup company or a big company?
So the master plan includes sort of plans for sounds like a tech or like a research, almost like an incubator. Or
yeah,
like
bio hub.
Here at the UC Davis campus
in Sacramento. Yeah.
Here at UC Davis Medical.
Yeah, so between our Institute for Regenerative Cures, which is
That's
at
exciting.
The corner of Stockton and Broadway, and the hospital, there's a couple of blocks of prime real estate that are now a parking lot and a pile of dirt where they built the new school of nursing, and the dirt came over to us. But that's where all the plans and blueprints are being developed, and it's a really exciting time.
And so there's and so you're working, you said, with the mayor.
Yes, the university is working with the mayor and
to entice companies to come to come to us and to come this way. That is so
exciting.
Here's the scoop. You're
here from us.
Time.
Yeah,
that is amazing.
Yes, really,
that's
really.
Is there
exciting.
A timeline for this, or
as soon as possible?
As soon as possible.
We're hoping to have some food there, have a few businesses, and some housing for the students to live.
Oh, wow.
It'll be really a great campus. Yeah.
And so your role in this is sort of to be as a an ambassador to the industry, or to
do
some outreach, or how does that work?
So one thing that we do a lot with our good manufacturing practice facility, which is where we grow the cell doses for human application, and our program, we do a lot of what's called fee-for-service for industry partners. So we're already working with a wide spectrum of companies, and now we can offer them a footprint to actually have part or all of their company here near us. And take advantage of our trainees and the talent that we have here, and everything that we have to offer, and the manufacturing that's right there. So they'll come and spend like a week with us to manufacture product and kind of hang out and watch, you know, but they want to be more a part of it.
Oh, wow.
It's really exciting, yeah.
And if they can settle down in Sacramento, why not?
Why not?
I've found it absolutely, an absolutely wonderful place to live. So, yeah, I feel like the tough things, there's no, like, one big thing to come visit. Like, we don't have, like, the Arch in St. Louis or something like that. But the quality of the day-to-day people that I've met in the city, and just the, just everything about it, there's something so charmed about it to me. You left for a little while and you came back, and you said you're from here.
Yeah, I actually grew up in Willows, which is just north of here, but I went to school here from the time I was, like, 16. And I came to Sac State, lived in the dorms. The same dorm is still there, Jenkins Hall. And then I was here for a while, started my master's at UC Davis. And then I went down to Los Angeles to start working on this new thing called blood-forming stem cell gene therapy, hematopoietic stem cell gene therapy. And my mentor was Dr. Don Cohn. And so we continued that for 15 years in Los Angeles. He's now continue to refine those techniques to cure the 30 kids of bubble baby disease that
I
mentioned
earlier. Can you explain that to us a little bit?
Yeah, so you take
or even bubble baby disease.
Bubble baby disease is where the child does not have an immune system and they have to live in a plastic bubble.
Oh, wow.
So there was a Bubble Boy movie, that's why they call it that, with John Travolta back in the 80s, I guess.
Okay.
The boy in the plastic bubble.
So I hope this doesn't sound crude, but the Seinfeld episode with the kid.
Yes, that's what that was
that's
all
what
about.
It is, 'cause
yeah.
He has no immune system.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And so they couldn't be hugged by their parents or anything, they just had to live in a bubble.
Sort of uniquely isolated.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And then, you know, an enzyme was developed, enzyme therapy, but the kids would have to have shots all the time, and now they can get this one-time gene therapy. So Don and his team will take some of their bone marrow, insert a good copy of the broken gene, put the bone marrow back into the patient. You just put it in the arm, it goes back into the bones and continues to make all of the blood cells for the lifetime of the patient.
Oh my goodness.
So
and that's it.
Yeah, that's blood-forming gene therapy. It's a
shot. They're cured.
They are cured. These kids are cured. No more medicine.
The cured bubble baby disease.
Right. Yeah. And so that's what I started on. That's what we worked on the first 15 years.
That was your first
years.
Thing
yeah.
was to help cure.
So I was hooked.
Disease.
I mean, I was hooked with working on,
that's
hooked
incredible.
On working with clinicians, with really committed doctors who wanted to help their patients like Don.
Can I ask you something?
Yeah.
What's that? You know, I learned a new technique in jujitsu and I'm through the roof.
Yeah.
You know, and that's not actually. That's not a social benefit at all.
No,
just
that's
my
good
mom.
For you.
What's that moment like when you realize maybe I don't even know what it's like. You walk away from your project and you come back the next morning and you realize that it took in the right way. What's that eureka moment like?
You know, it's you would think.
Are there moments like that where you're just like, I know.
You would think that scientists would just have like a big huge eureka moment. Those come really infrequently. It's more, and I think maybe the students expect those more often. But it's really small incremental steps.
Okay.
So we started the first Bubble Baby clinical trials in 1990, and it worked, but the cells didn't really engraft because we couldn't give the patients anything to clear their marrow first, and it took that long to actually really work.
Wow.
Until just like the last couple of years, and Don continued to work hard at it and refine the techniques. And yeah, I went off to St. Louis and then came back here 10 years ago. Yeah, the Midwest was not for me, but I did meet an awesome husband there. Hi, honey. So yeah, came back to California when the Prop 71 passed, and this was becoming the place to be for stem cells. So it was time to come home.
So rather than the big eureka moment, we're looking at sort of like a series of incremental changes,
yeah,
and a lot of persistence,
yeah,
and sort of diligently keeping your...
Once in a while you get the eureka moment. So I had
like?
One back working with Don where we realized that we could insert the gene into the actual stem cell that made all of the cells in the blood system. And that was actually a moment when a blot came out and you saw that everything matched. And I still have that sheet. You know, they came out of the machine, yeah, and I remember looking at it and just bursting into tears because it would work. So
that's
great.
So interesting. And it's just,
yeah,
this printout.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh my goodness.
It's a, yeah, it's the same in these and these. That means they're from the same stem cell. It could work.
Probably, oh my
that was, what, 30 years ago?
And you
28
still have
years
it?
Ago. I still have it, yeah. People say, what's that ugly old thing? Oh, that's a really important ugly old thing. Well, old school style.
You know? Oh, you're going to have to get it for you.
Yeah, it's in my office somewhere.
Did you, could you talk a little bit more about the sort of progress that you've made on the other diseases that you've worked on? I know that Huntington's is a,
yeah,
is a particular passion of yours. Is there?
Yeah, I saw it for Huntington's disease. We had one of my students, he's kind of like my grand student because my postdoctoral fellow, Kyle Fink, brilliant young man, just got his associate professor designation, and he has this student, Peter. This morning I got to see Peter's qualifying exam and just blew me away what they're doing to try to treat Huntington's disease, and just remarkable progress. So that's, you know, it's still a few years away from clinical trials, but really remarkable. We are working on many different things. Tay-Sachs disease, you asked earlier about the, like the really, the big diseases, like, and I went into critical limb ischemia, that affects a lot of people.
Okay.
Heart attack affects a lot of people, stroke, things like that.
I'll just interrupt,
yeah,
you there quickly. I thought I was having some heart issues. I very well may, but we're still trying to figure
out. I hope
out. Not. Yeah, I hope not too. But I was looking at this chart of like what kills people, you know. It was like a relative size chart, and like heart was like this big, and the next big one was like cancer, and it was like that big.
I know.
And so the heart diseases are what that, like,
it's,
are,
yeah,
really
terrible. So
people.
all the vascular disease is terrible. But so we work hard on those. There are a lot of clinical trials ongoing for vascular related issues. But as a research team, we're able to follow our hearts, and work on the rare diseases and kind of work where our heart takes us. And so that's what got us into Huntington's disease and juvenile Huntington's disease, even more heartbreaking. But these other rare called orphan diseases, because they
that's
don't have
right,
a lot
that's
of
what
people.
I heard
orphan
before,
disease,
sorry.
Yeah. They don't have a lot of people studying them. Not a lot of people have them. And there's really not a profit for the companies to make
and
on
so
them.
Have a lot of,
so that's
patrons.
Where, yeah, so that's where it would be really useful to develop one type of platform for one of those diseases and then be able to use that same platform, just maybe change the gene a little bit and to fit the patient population.
There's this like intersectionality that happens between like private and public institutions,
mm-hmm,
right? Like the private institutions have the, of course, the profit motive, but also means they're able to quickly scale. They drive research. A number of, I think, social goods, but might not necessarily be the first to come to bear for an orphan disease. Is that a role where you think government can step in and say, for want of the social good, though there might not be a private sector patron, patronage for research into this disease, or is that something that CIRM might be able to back? Is that how it works?
CIRM has been great at funding funding disease across the board. So it doesn't have to be one of the big ones like diabetes or heart. They will fund these orphan diseases. They've been fantastic. The National Institutes of Health, as they're able, they never have enough money for what they want to do, but and I sure hope the budget doesn't get cut for next year. But they fund orphan diseases. They have an orphan disease center.
Okay.
And so, the public funding is really, does not exclude the rare diseases. But we find that it's really the motivated family and philanthropic donations for people concerned about a loved one or with a particular mission. They really get the ball rolling.
Okay.
It's interesting for those really rare diseases.
So there's still plenty of space for advocates too.
Yeah. And nobody might even know about some of these diseases if not for the patient advocates. So really important.
So how might a platform, you were talking about a platform for one disease to then be able to change it and help treat other diseases. How mm-hmm. might that work? Is this like I hear a lot of talk about like CRISPR.
Yeah.
And we were talking earlier about how technology is sort of changing the pace of development in different fields. Is this something where CRISPR might come to bear? Or?
Sure, CRISPR or other gene editing or gene modifying techniques. If you can develop one and work out the delivery issues, such as how to get it into the brain, then you could change what it targets and use it for different diseases. And you just have to repeat the efficacy and the safety. But once you get that all worked out, so that's where it's really important for scientists to work together and to share things in a really timely manner.
Oh, interesting. When you look at the timeline of all the different things that you've worked on, does there seem to be a hastening of the pace of development in the last 10 to 15 years?
Oh, yeah. We have much better toys now. By toys, I mean lab equipment and ways to, sequencing the genome is huge. We have amazing genomic databases now. You can take a patient sample and have the full genome sequenced, overnight, basically, for a couple $1,000s. I mean, that when I first started, we couldn't even dream of that, that exploding head emoji. That makes everything so much easier. So you were asking about CRISPR, gene targeting, gene editing, gene modifying, knowing where to hit the DNA, to silence it or change it, critical. And we have amazing imaging these days, amazing microscopes. UC Davis is developing a whole body PET imaging system.
Okay.
So to know, for instance, if cancer has spread, look at the whole body, or to track our stem cells after we inject them.
What is
really amazing? PET is it's not for pets. It's I'm going to say it wrong. Positron electron tomography. I think it's imaging of they put in some radioactive label on the cells or to find the tumor, and so you can see now the whole body. Yeah. That's the Explorer project.
That's incredible.
Going on here at UC Davis and nowhere else in the world. So
really?
One of the amazing things, yeah. So just a lot
how
of new
along,
tools.
How far
coming.
Along is that?
They've made the pet imager, so for dogs and cats, and one for non-human primates. And so those prototypes are out on our veterinary school.
Oh, that's so exciting.
And they're working on the huge... the larger one for the human patients, and I got to see it the other day. It's actually in the end of our building, so very exciting. Yeah.
Is there any other developments going on over at UC Davis Sciences that you're sort of particularly excited about that you want to share?
Where do I even start? I mean, everything's just so exciting. I love coming into work every day. It's just
that's a blessing, isn't it?
I come in and it's like, what did this team do? What did that team do? So I can't even narrow it down into one. It's just, it's a really exciting time to be there and to be here in Sacramento.
That's amazing. Okay, so I was hoping I could go through, I have a list of here of your publications.
Oh boy.
I was hoping I could go through some of them, read them to you, and maybe you could explain to us in layman's
really?
Is that something you're willing to do?
Sure.
We can actually cut this out.
Oh yeah, okay.
but I was just hoping to sort of
Yeah.
better highlight what you were doing. Okay. Small interfering RNA-mediated decreases in c-MET levels affect the differentiation potential of human mesenchymal stem cells and reduce their capacity for tissue repair.
Yeah. So,
what is that?
Mesenchymal stem cells are the ones that are in the bone marrow.
Cells,
right? Yeah, they nurse the other cells, take care of them. They're the paramedic cells. In that one, we're trying to study the basic biology of the cells. If we knock down a certain receptor that they have on the surface, then they can't crawl around as much. They stay in place. We used hypoxia in that, which is lower oxygen, and changed what they do. Yeah, so it was just first report of that type of stuff.
Very cool.
Modifying them, yeah.
Can we do one more?
Yeah.
Oh, so revascularization. Fluorophore conjugated iron oxide nanoparticle labeling and analysis of engrafting human stem cells.
Yeah, that's I was just talking about the PET imaging and the imaging. So that paper is to load the stem cells with something where we can visualize them before we sent them into the patient, which was in a mouse with no immune system at that point, and see where the cells go. And one of the first reports with after intravenous infusion, where would these cells go?
So before that, it was just kind of you would just put them into the test subject and they're off to the races,
before,
but who knows where they would go.
Before doing that paper, we would inject them into the mice, and then we'd have to, you know, take down the mouse, look at every organ and do cross sections through every organ to see where our cells were. But with this, we could take a picture over time and see where they go in the live
so
mouse.
Cool.
Yeah.
That is so cool. With clear implications
imaging.
For treating.
Yeah.
Imaging.
Sure.
Interesting. Okay. Immunodeficient mouse models to study human stem cell mediated repair of tissue injury.
Yeah, so we have a large vivarium in our building with mice with no immune system, and that's how we study what the human stem cells do. So we put human blood cells, human cells in their brain, human cells in their liver, and that's what the Food and Drug Agency wants to see, is that these human cells, the human product, are safe and efficacious. And we like to use rodent models because, I don't know, I could never work on a dog or anything like that. It's just the little mice, and they're little white mice, and they have no immune system.
On.
Yeah, a lot easier.
When we're talking about, you're talking about here stem cell mediated repair of tissue injury, it's just like, I have a badly damaged patellar tendon on my left knee. You know, I've strengthened the eccentric muscles. I've done the physical therapy that I can. I've gotten to, it seems that I've gotten to a point where I'm never going to like run like I ran in high school, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I now have the option of maybe going into surgery to try and repair that. But much of what I read about this particular surgery is, you know, avoid the knife if you can.
Yeah.
But I'm just sort of kind of hobbling around with a bad patellar tendon on my left knee. My understanding of the issue is that these many of these tendons don't have the same blood flow and sort of nutrient delivery to them as a muscle, right?
Right.
Is this sort of something that your work might come to bear on? Now, I know that, like, for example, in Germany, I can go to Germany, I can't do it here, but I can go to Germany and get stem cells shot into my knee. Two questions. Why can't I do that here? Is there a good reason why we can't do it here? Are we sort of getting to that point, and sort of what comes with that?
Really good question. So we are studying stem cells for athletic injuries on our sports medicine team and in our equine athletes, in our horses.
Oh,
so
I thought you meant jockeys.
It's pretty it's our horses out at the equine health center at the number one vet school in the nation. Yay! And so they take the horses on cells, they grow them out in a GMP facility, kind of like ours, but it's for animals, and they put them back in. We can repair, we can repair a lot of soft tissue injuries, really not the tendons yet, although people are working on it.
Okay.
So you have to be careful when you read, and also the knees, the cartilage in the knees, you know, getting there, but not quite yet.
What
the stem cells can do is they can really reduce inflammation.
Okay.
But with a long-time chronic injury, there's probably not a lot of inflammation ongoing, and you can take anti-inflammatories or turmeric, one of my favorite things, to reduce inflammation there. So the stem cells would, you know, reduce the inflammation, but we can't get them to really resurface the cartilage yet or regrow that tendon. And we're trying to get them to do that. And one of the reasons for tendon and cartilage is that as they grow and develop, they need pressure on them. And so we need specially developed methods and machines to grow them and keep the pressure on them as they grow and they form that tissue.
The penguin egg needs the penguin to sit on it.
Yeah, exactly. And so people are working on that. It's just not quite there yet. So when you see these stem cell clinics on the internet claiming that they can do everything from curing autism to fixing your knee to fixing your tendons, you want to really look into those claims. Make sure the people running them are, you know, doctors, first of all. And then maybe there's some published science behind it. And the International Society for Stem Cell Research has put out a really great patient guidebook that I think everybody should read.
The International Society for Stem Cell Research.
If they're thinking about something like that, yeah.
Okay.
And so that's why it's not quite available in the U.S. yet, because we just don't have strong evidence that things like that work yet. A lot of things work.
Is it dangerous to put that in your fiddle?
If we don't know what they're putting in. So there have been some of these, you know, they're not covered by the FDA at all, right? If it's a rogue clinic. So they could be putting in contaminated saline. We don't know because they're not covered. They're not under, you know, FDA surveillance like we are.
Wow.
So you want to be really careful. And I've had so many questions about that. And I just wish that I could get the word out to everybody, you know, that... you want to really look into where you're going, because they'll have really slick websites and a lot of stuff on the walls, and they might even affiliate themselves with clinicaltrials.gov, which is where all the clinical trials are listed. But you just want to be careful.
Not
quite yet. Our FDA is great. Our Food and Drug Administration is great. We work with them all the time. They really want to help patients. If something is working, they really want to get it to the patients. They just don't want to cause harm.
Good to know. Good to know. I'm greatly enjoying this. Can we do one more?
Sure. Okay. You're good at reading those words, too. Doing a good job.
Functional characterization of highly purified human stem cells isolated based on aldehyde dehydrogenase activity.
Yes. That's a way to take out the stem cells that can form the blood and the blood vessels and these pyramidic cells. And they all share one property, that they have high levels of this aldehyde dehydrogenase activity. And so somebody had developed a system where you can interrogate inside the living cell and sort them. We have a laser that asks the cell, what kind of cell are you? Do you have it? Do you not have it? And if you have it, you go into a tube. And so we get a lot of the primitive adult stem cells in the tube.
Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
That is pretty cool.
Pretty exciting.
That is pretty cool. So your day to day, are you still doing research?
Yeah.
I mean, you're the head of the facility. So are you sort of reluctantly shifted into like an administrative role almost?
Oh, not reluctantly. I think I have the best job in the world. So I'm not at the bench doing the research anymore, but that's okay because I did that for, you know, 17 years,
yeah,
20 hours a day. And, it's hard to take a break when you're at the bench. And, I get to go in the morning and meet with all the different teams that are doing the data. They show me the data. We interpret it. We design the next experiments to do. We write papers together. We write grants together. We write clinical protocols together for clinical trials. And so it hasn't been reluctant. I remember one day I did like my 10,000th repeat of some lab test, and I just thought, I can let the students do this now. I think I'm okay going into the office now.
Good for you.
Yeah. Good for you.
Absolutely. You mentioned a little earlier that you've been here in Sacramento, at Willows, Davis. You've been in the region for a little while now.
Yeah.
Shifting gears a little bit about our city that we all share and love. How have you seen Sacramento change? Are you pleased? What do you see as in as sort of like the positive developments for Sacramento? And you've been here for a while.
I'm, you know, so happy with the new arena, being the Farm to Fork capital. Of course, we still love our river. We have a boat going out on the river.
Oh,
it's wonderful. Yeah.
Do you like Juicy's down in the Delta?
I, you know, I don't take the time to go that far down. We just go up to Swabies or something. Just close. Or like from the marina to Old Sac. That's like a block. But anyway, I don't get out on it as much as I would like to. But there are just so many great things about Sacramento. And, you know, the tech has grown. Small businesses are moving here. We hope some larger businesses will continue to move here. And there's really a lot of team spirit and camaraderie, a lot of art. It's a beautiful city, city of trees, great restaurants. I mean, I always like to try new restaurants and bars.
I was hoping to put you on the spot there.
Yeah,
okay.
Love them.
Your favorite place to grab a bite to eat?
Oh, favorite. Oh, that's hard to narrow down. Well, for lunch, going down to La Venedita, that's right down the street, right down Broadway in Oak Park. That neighborhood's really coming around. It's awesome.
Oh, that one's new.
It's great. It's like cafeteria style, but yeah, great margaritas. I don't know. We go to so many places. That's the one to hit from work. And then we just had a Oba Kitchen opened up right next to our building. So really happy about that. It's sushi and Japanese food.
They're run by these. Right, bacon and butter. Yeah. Love the place. It's just tough to get in the
just
door.
Right around us there.
Just tough to get in the door. Okay, well, I think that's been pretty comprehensive.
Yeah.
We're at just under an hour.
Great.
Is there anything else that you think folks should know? How can we support the work that you're doing? Sort of final thoughts.
We're always happy for people to come visit us and see what we're doing and learn about research. And we are working really hard to help improve healthcare for humans and also for animals. A lot of clinical trials ongoing for pets. So if you have a dog or cat with a problem and stem cells might be able to help, they'll take some stem cells out of its fat and try it.
Oh, wow.
So a lot of clinical trials ongoing in our vet school. And we learn from them, we work together. And we have currently 24 clinical trials ongoing or just completed for humans. Probably about that many for animals out on the vet school campus. And we have about 20 human clinical trials in the pipeline. So this is definitely a good place to be for healthcare and for stem cells.
Great. Well, thank you so much, everybody. This has been our first episode of Sacktown Talks. We hope you enjoyed the talk.
I enjoyed it.
Tune in. We'll have more conversations with Sacramento's movers, shakers, and eclectic personalities. Thank you.